first case, please?
On behalf of the Commonwealth, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Okay.
This appeal arises from a circuit court judgment denying in part and granting in part a habeas corpus petition. The decision of the circuit court was in error for 3 reasons. The circuit court erred in finding that it had jurisdiction to consider 2 convictions when the petitioner in that case had fully served his sentences at the time that he filed his petition. Second, the circuit court erred in refusing to consider the strength of the Commonwealth's case in determining whether it was reasonable. It would have been a reasonable decision for the defendant to decide not to go to trial had he been properly advised. And finally, the circuit court erred in finding that there was a reasonable probability that the defendant would have gone to trial had he been properly advised, because in this case, the defendant did not challenge the Commonwealth's evidence, which in fact was overwhelming. He did not offer any defenses had he gone to trial. And had he gone to trial, the outcome in the case would have been the same as the outcome that resulted from his guilty plea.
Ms. Adelphia, ordinarily, I would just let counsel go on with the order of their argument. With the limited amount of time that you have and the significance of some procedural issues, I'm going to ask you if you'll address those first, because they may very well be dispositive of the entire case.
Of course, Your Honor.
And there's 2 issues I want to talk to you about. This is an unusual posture for a habeas case. Usually we have a convicted person who is seeking habeas who didn't get it, and they are now on appeal to this court. It's a little odd to have the Commonwealth being the appellant in a case like this. But the odd nature of it actually raises one significant issue related to that, and then the second one. In the court below, there's 3 convictions. There's 1 possession of marijuana conviction, there's another embezzlement conviction, and there's a 3rd conviction for possession of paraphernalia. On the first 2 that I've mentioned, the Commonwealth prevailed. There was no writ of habeas corpus issued. Now, where it puts us is that the Commonwealth prevailed below. The Commonwealth is no longer aggrieved because you prevailed. And as a result, what you have is no active controversy. So the first question is, other than receiving an advisory opinion from this court, what possible relief does the Commonwealth get for those 2 cases when they already won?
Your Honor, I'd suggest that this case, that it's not moot, because the issues are capable of repetition yet evading review.
This is not a question of mootness. This is a question of whether or not you're aggrieved at all, whether there's any kind of controversy that we can get. What kind of relief do we give you?
Well, Your Honor, I think that you can always challenge the subject matter jurisdiction of a court to enter a decision. And in this case, the circuit court did not have subject matter jurisdiction to
consider. But you're not in that court. You're in this court. You can challenge the subject matter of jurisdiction of the court you're in, but you're not there.
Your Honor, I think I would just reiterate, this is a situation that is capable of repetition yet evading review. Typically, I think that anecdotally I can tell the court that usually the Commonwealth prevails with respect to this jurisdictional argument. And in those cases, a petitioner is typically removed from the country prior to his ability to appeal.
You realize this is not a mootness question. This is a standing question.
Your Honor, unfortunately, I think that this is the only answer I can give you with respect to
I understand, but I have to tell you, I cannot see the standing of the Commonwealth to appeal a case they won. All right, the second question is equally important, probably a little more favorable to you. When the legislature changed the habeas statute to add paragraph 3 of section 8.01654, it says such petition may allege detention without lawful authority through challenge to a conviction, although the sentence imposed for such conviction is suspended or is to be served subsequently to the sentence currently being served by the petitioner. So with regard to the paraphernalia case, the question is, and let me add to this, the legislature apparently didn't clean up the next statute. It says the writ shall be directed to the person in whose custody the petitioner is detained. And then the service says the writ shall be served on the person to whom it is directed. It would have been helpful if the legislature had cleared up the obvious problem. If you have a suspended sentence and you're not in custody, who is the person?
Your Honor,
I'll just ask the question in a manner that probably is better suited for an answer. In this case, the petitioner named the Commonwealth of Virginia and served the Commonwealth's attorney. I know you mentioned this in your brief, but in order to comply with the statute, wouldn't the petitioner have to name the potential custodian? And that potential custodian would not, in this case, be the Department of Corrections because it's a misdemeanor. So consequently, the potential custodian would be the sheriff of Prince William County.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So if that is correct, and if you
I'm
believe
sorry.
It...
I gave a wrong answer. Because he was on probation, or because there was some, I believe that he was on probation at the time that he filed his petition, and because, given that, it would be the Department of Director, excuse me, the Director of the Department of Corrections.
Well, the Director of the Department of Corrections would not have any authority over his custody. So you probably gave the right answer.
Okay.
but there's a next, the next question is the more interesting one in some respects. Having named the Commonwealth and had no objection to that below, is that subject to waiver? Or does that make this petition by the convicted, by Mr. Barreras, does that make this case subject to dismissal for having named the wrong party?
Does it make his original petition subject
right,
to dismissal?
The entire case.
Your Honor, I would suggest that it does. It came, this is not on brief, but it is in the record. When the petition was originally filed, the Office of the Attorney General was ordered to respond. The Office of the Attorney General moved to sever the conviction, the case, because it challenged three misdemeanors that were not related to each other. And at the time that they... We moved to dismiss without prejudice and to give the petitioner an opportunity to refile. And with respect to the two convictions where the petitioner was not in any state custody, we had no issue with the fact that the Commonwealth was named. I think that there is an issue...
Problem with that is the only custody he was in was the custody of the federal government for immigration issues.
And I think that goes to the Commonwealth's point, or the Office of the Attorney General's point, which is because a state actor cannot be named in those cases, they were not proper state habeas corpus cases.
Well, but if you have subsection 3 that says you can have a habeas petition when you're not actually confined but are looking at a suspended sentence, you have to serve somebody if that's the basis. And, of course, for the paraphernalia case, that is the basis, that he had a suspended sentence. And it was he still had, I think it was, 330 days left on that or something like that? 28 days, that's right, 28 days left on that one. So then the question, if that is the only thing left in the case, and assume that it is for the sake of this question, he has 28 days remaining. He's not in custody, and he's not in custody, apparently, of ICE anymore anyway. Who do you name? And it seems to me that the only answer to that question is it can't be the Commonwealth generally. That's not a person. So who do you name?
Well, I believe that you're correct, Justice Lemons. It would be the sheriff. And I would suggest to the court that I repeatedly raised the fact that the Commonwealth was not the proper respondent.
Right. Yeah, there's no question you do. There's no indication of who you thought was, which I guess I can understand. It takes a little bit of doing to work through these statutes to figure out who it possibly could be. But, all right, well, now, if you'd like to proceed on the non-procedural issue, go right ahead.
These are very important issues, and I'd much prefer to answer any questions the court have than guess what the court is interested in. I will not discuss the jurisdictional argument. I think that my time would be better served discussing the second and third assignments of error, which are interrelated. To determine that it would be rational to reject the guilty plea, this court must conduct an objective analysis and consider the circumstances the petitioner would have faced at the time of his decision. In Padilla cases, habeas court ought to consider a number of circumstances in determining whether it would have been rational for a petitioner to go to trial.
So let me ask you, though, isn't this case a little bit different because the charge he pled guilty to was a charge he was never charged with? Can't we just balance whether it was ineffective to plead to a charge he was never charged with than to plead or try the one that he was charged with?
I think you have to determine whether it would have been rational for him to go to trial on the original marijuana charge. And I would suggest that it would not have been rational because the evidence was overwhelming against him.
But wouldn't it have been rational to plead to the original marijuana charge, perhaps?
It did not matter, Your Honor, and that is that what the trial court found, or excuse me, the circuit court found. The circuit court found at Joint Appendix page 137 through 138 that had he been found guilty of the original marijuana charge, he's equally removable from the country.
But my understanding was he would not be able to ask for cancellation. That's the big difference between the paraphernalia and the marijuana conviction.
And, Your Honor, Padilla does not relate to advice with respect to cancellation. Padilla only relates to whether or not an attorney must advise with respect to the mandatory deportation removal. And I would suggest that the logic behind that is that cancellation is a much more complicated analysis, and it's not succinct, clear, and immediately obvious whether someone qualifies for a cancellation.
I'm glad you said that,
because
that's certainly what I thought when I read it. But so I appreciate your confirming that. But even so, if you give up any benefit by pleading guilty to the paraphernalia, any possible chance of cancellation, why would you plead to the paraphernalia rather than plead to the marijuana?
I'd suggest that they were equally detrimental to his relief. And I think that a number of cases say that the prospect of cancellation is so speculative that it's not a fair factor in a habeas corpus analysis. It's fair to consider whether or not you fall under the 43 categories of aggravated felonies that would lead to your deportation. It's not fair to determine whether or not someone would qualify for relief under the Convention Against Torture, under 1229B. There's just the cancellation statutes are not as clear and succinct.
Isn't the dilemma in this case is that the paraphernalia charge is not limited to what would otherwise be a misdemeanor? I mean, paraphernalia extends to possession of a crack pipe, for example, which would lead a person looking at the conviction to say, well, what kind of paraphernalia did you have?
Well, I think that the, if I may ask the court question, what person is looking at the conviction? The immigration court?
Immigration, right.
The immigration court. I think that the immigration court, the difficulty I have in answering Your Honor's question is that I do not appear before the immigration court, so I can only speculate as to what happens in immigration court. But my understanding of immigration court is that you present the facts, the underlying facts, and that petitioners have the opportunity to say, well, these were the facts, and then of the case.
The odd thing about this is that the lawyer apparently told his client, you know, if you plead guilty to the misdemeanor possession of marijuana charge, you're going to lose your driver's license. And he said, I don't want that. He said, all right, well, we'll work it out to make it paraphernalia. But what that means is that he's saying to his client, you can keep your driver's license, but you're likely to be driving on streets in a different country.
Well, I think that Your Honor also has to consider that this was the petitioner committed four offenses in the course of a year. They were all misdemeanor offenses. When he was convicted of the marijuana offense, when he was convicted of the paraphernalia offense, he already had one marijuana conviction. He had an embezzlement conviction. And so that those were factors that would be considered at sentencing. And Meyer v. Branker suggests that when the evidence is overwhelming, and I'm sorry, that's a Fourth Circuit case, when the evidence is overwhelming and there is no chance of success at trial, you do receive a sentencing benefit, and it is rational to go to accept a guilty plea if you have no chance of success at trial. And in this case, there has been no allegation that the petitioner would have been successful had he gone to trial either in the marijuana case or the paraphernalia case. In fact, he testified at the evidentiary hearing essentially to all the facts of the case, which was he had marijuana all over him, there was a bag of marijuana at his feet, and there's been no suggestion, and he bears the burden of showing that it would have been reasonable to go to trial. And if I might reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Sorry, but it's gone.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
If it pleases the court, I am Alfred Robertson. I represent Marvin Borja Barrera.
Mr. Robertson, before you get into your argument, I'd like to ask you a question. The court is interested to know why you did not respond to its directive for you to file additional pleadings in this case. Not only did we send a letter to you directing you to do that, but our clerk has called you twice and you still haven't done it.
I got the one phone call, Your Honor, and I don't really have an excuse, except that I agreed with the Commonwealth's position in their letter brief. I should have written a letter that stated that a simple letter of two sentences that said I agreed with their position probably would have been the best course of action. I don't have any other excuse, Judge. I got too busy to get it done, and I know that's not an excuse, and I don't know what else to say about it, except that I need to make sure that those things don't happen.
Go ahead and proceed.
Your Honor, to address the question of jurisdiction, and I think jurisdiction is probably the most important issue in this case, the two convictions that were fully served, as it's been termed, Judge Johnston looked at that and in his orders was fairly clear about it, and it essentially is the question I have. If not the circuit court, who? There would be nowhere to go with a constitutional violation and a constitutionally affirmed conviction if the circuit court didn't have jurisdiction. The habeas corpus statute says you have to bring it within 2 years. The habeas corpus, the cases that this court has determined, Carroll and EC, both say that Carroll especially says that the statute should be is remedial in nature and should be liberally construed. And in that case, the court can be able to consider those convictions. And if the court had granted habeas relief, it would have been there's a different question to it. The court, though, does bring, the court does bring an interesting point as to whether or not there is standing on those two convictions, and whether or not the parties are aggrieved. I hadn't thought of the argument, Your Honor. I wish I had. I'm kind of surprised at it, and I wish I had brought it up.
Well, that one actually favors you. Yeah. The next one.
Well, the second one, and who is naming of the potential custodian, which custodian it would be, Your Honor, I think that it is subject to waiver. I think I think it's something that should have been brought up directly to the circuit court in a motion to dismiss. The Attorney General's office, I think, filed five different motions to dismiss and supplemental motions to dismiss in this case, beginning with the first one that basically said you need to file a separate habeas corpus petition for each conviction. It was a very strongly fought case from the Attorney General's office, as well as should have been.
Well, on that question, if it is subject to waiver, perhaps it is, but if it is, to whom do we direct relief, if there is any relief?
It would have to be, the only way that I could think of doing that would be to name the potential custodian that should be named would be the sheriff of the local county in a case where there is a suspended sentence. I think the court stated it well when it said the potential custodian. is probably the most appropriate way to go in arguing these cases. And I know in my future habeas cases on suspended court, this case is on suspended sentences, I am going to direct them to the sheriff, only because it does make more sense.
If you had a felony suspended case, you probably would be correct.
To Harold Clark.
To the Department of Corrections.
Right.
It'd probably be safer to name both the Department of Corrections and the sheriff and let them figure it out.
Probably, Your Honor.
But right now, what we have a case that names the Commonwealth and a statute that requires that relief be directed to a person. So even if it's subject to waiver, and even if they didn't contest it below, to whom do we direct relief if there is any?
I believe that it would be directed to the sheriff of the local jurisdiction.
The sheriff is not a party.
I don't know, Your Honor. I wish I had a better answer.
Well, let me take another
maybe it should be to the court. Maybe it should be to the general district court or the circuit court.
Well, when you think back to what the circuit court did in this case, then they directed an order be sent to the district court.
They did, and that's what I was thinking, was the district court might have been the way to go, is that the order is directed to the district court.
Well, let me take you a further step down this road. If there's no person to whom we can direct the order if we granted relief, then why isn't anything we do in this case advisory?
Because we're talking about jurisdiction, and the jurisdiction of the circuit court to determine whether or not a habeas corpus should be heard or not. This is an important case. It's an important case to people who have already served the 1 year after their conviction and they don't have the...
Oh, I agree it's important, but important doesn't mean that it's okay if it's advisory at the end of the day.
I don't think it is advisory in the sense that it directly addresses the jurisdiction of the circuit court and what the circuit court can do. I think it is, in that case, if I was making the argument, if I was the appellant, I don't think it would be as advisory as it is that I'm being the appellee. I think it would end up being more advisory as the appellee than as the appellant's condition. Because the appellee in this case, it was July 30th, I think, is when he obtained relief from the immigration court and was released. I argued that case in the immigration court. I do appear in front of the immigration court. The immigration court does not look behind the facts of the conviction. The immigration court says, you were convicted of paraphernalia. That's a controlled substances violation, according to our jurisprudence. And that's it. That's the final. Just to answer that question, I don't want to get too far away from your question, Justice.
No, my concern is if there's no person to whom we can direct relief, then what do we do with this case?
I wish I had a better answer, Judge. I really don't. I think the way the circuit court handled it, addressing it to the general district court, was appropriate.
Where does that authority come from, to direct it to the general district court?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Where's the authority to direct it to the general district court?
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know, Justice.
I mean, it's creative.
It
makes sense, but where's the authority to do that?
The circuit court has, as this court's aware, the circuit court has broad inherent authority to do a lot of different things in the order and aid of its jurisdiction. I think the court relying on the statutes that give it broad discretion in aid of its jurisdiction would probably be the most appropriate authority to look at for the court to direct it to the general district court in this particular case. To go on, the strength of the evidence issue, which is brought up by the Attorney General in talking about the paraphernalia conviction, I cited in my brief, and I think the court should take a strong look at Roe versus Flores Ortega out of the U.S. Supreme Court. That was a case that involved a misperfected appeal, and the court basically said, there's prejudice because there's nothing to look at. And that's the same thing that we have here. Justice Lemon brought up that, hey, you plead guilty to paraphernalia, you get to keep your driver's license. Oh, well, I'm not going to look at whether or not the evidence is admissible. I'm not going to consider whether or not a jury is going to convict over what is commonly referred to as shake. flakes of marijuana on his shirt, which is what the facts of this case were. There's a lot of questions as to whether a jury would have convicted on the small amount of marijuana that was involved in that case. But none of those questions were really examined, and you really can't look at any of it to determine whether it was reasonable to go to trial or not. I can't allege that it was reasonable for him to go to trial if I don't have anything to look at. There were no suppression motions, there was no examination of the evidence, I don't know what discovery was given. Those are issues that without knowing what they are, when you're alleging in a habeas corpus petition that you really can't say that I would have gone to trial, because you don't know what the evidence is. Because it's non-existent, because of the way the case was handled in the general district court, that it went to plea so very, very quickly, and a plea to something that he couldn't have been convicted of based on the facts of the case anyway, there's nothing there to say you could have gone to trial, and that's how you should allege the case. Roe versus Flores-Otega basically says there's nothing there if the court should be assuming prejudice. And justices, I think that's the strength of my argument. I will rely on my briefs after that.
Before you sit down, if this is just one person talking, right? We have seven of us here for a reason, right? But if for some reason the first two convictions are not resolved here because there's no standing, and the paraphernalia is the only one left, and we were to decide that there's no proper party before the court, there's two ifs, and the third is that because of no proper party, there is a direction to vacate the order granting habeas corpus below because there was no proper party there either. It seems to me that your client is still in the best possible position because he's already been granted his release from the immigration authority.
And he was granted cancellation by the immigration court pursuant to the statutes. I hesitate to quote this saying 1229A. Immigration practitioners and immigration courts refer to the Immigration Nationality Act by its internal numbers. Right. So it's INA 240A is what was commonly referred to.
But I guess the question is, and I hope it's not a speculative kind of question, but I would guess that if we handled it that way, you wouldn't care because your client's already out.
Until the immigration authorities noticed that his conviction was reinstated, yes. They would have to actively investigate what's going on at this point. If this court vacated the habeas grant, they could very well take him back into custody and start the procedures all over again. But they would have, they're busy, and frankly, I mean, I don't really know another way to put it. They're busy. They may not notice. And that is completely speculative. They just simply may not notice.
But if they did notice, your client would be in exactly the same position he was in before.
He would, Justice. He would be back in front of that court, and we'd be back in there asking for the same sort of relief.
And I guess I won't speculate as to whether or not you have a problem in filing against the proper person, given the time that has elapsed.
I don't remember the date of the conviction for the paraphernalia. If it was more than 2 years ago, I would. It'd be beyond the statute of limitations. And I couldn't refile it.
Well, it would be beyond the jurisdiction of the court because the suspension... It's a misdemeanor, and the suspension is for a period of a year, and a year has clearly elapsed, which means he no longer falls under subsection 3.
I understand, John. I see that point. The only last thing to put in, just as the court is considering this case, and when you're thinking of cancellation, the best way to think of cancellation is to think of it as the 251 of immigration law. It's the best way to describe it. It's how I describe it to my clients, that you're seeking, because a lot of them know what 251 is, unfortunately. So they understand that 251 is a one-time grant of discretionary relief that's given by a judge. It's the same thing for cancellation. Cancellation is a one-time thing. You can't get it twice. But it does erase all sins. So going forward, he is still able, Mr. Borja Barrera will be able to, in 5 years or so, apply for citizenship. He will be, and maybe be able to get it. He's able to travel. He's able to leave the United States and come back in. Because the cancellation has cured his admissibility for travel and his deportability, as the case was decided in July.
Does it wipe the slate clean from this point backwards so that if his paraphernalia charge was reinstated, that would be the only mark on his record? Does cancellation wipe the slate clean?
Justice, I hadn't thought about that. I'd have to see because of the offense date. Sometimes the offense date controls more than the conviction date and more than how this court, if this court vacates the habeas grant, I think it would be problematic in immigration court. It may not be, though. And again, that's maybe I'm speculating as to whether or not what they would do. I do know that we would be in for a fight and that he would be in custody while we fought it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Call the next case, please.